being in the health and wellness world and in fitness, there was this expectation where people would look at me and they like couldn't believe, this is where education comes in. They like think fertility looks a certain way, right? It's like, but you look so healthy. You're so healthy. You drink green juice. You do this, this, and this. Like, I don't understand. And it's like fertility does not discriminate.
What would you do all over again and why? I'm Natalie Carpenter, women's health and fertility advocate, dot connector, and former corporate brand warrior. Each week, join me in candid conversation with an inspiring public figure who boldly shares their real-life stories of adversity, impact, and what they did next, and if they would do it all over again, knowing what they know now. Welcome to the All Over Again podcast. JC Gossett-Callan is a founding teacher of the class and VP of teacher training. Her classes are challenging, soulful, liberating, and welcoming. On today's episode of All Over Again, JC and I discussed movement, mental health, imposter syndrome, and fertility. Listen in to find out what JC would do all over again. Hi, JC. Welcome.
Hi, Natalie. Thanks so much for having me on your podcast.
Thank you so much for joining me on one of my very first episodes of All Over Again. This was just a dream when I saw you at the class retreat. And so I'm excited. It's happening and you're here and I get to see your beautiful face.
I'm here. We get to see each other. We saw each other. Was that April? Was that March?
March in Napa.
Yeah, that was March. We saw each other in Napa, the one-day class retreatment. At that point, this was just about to launch, right?
Exactly, about to launch.
Such a great concept. So cool.
It's been great. And we were in Napa, which was amazing. And I remember literally looking into, I mean, thank you for that crazy exercise of making me stare a stranger in the eyes for like minutes.
It's powerful. The eye gaze is powerful. I mean, so much happens in that one little exercise of feeling all our discomfort with being seen and also looking and being vulnerable and being close and then filtering through all the ideas and thoughts and narratives we either have about what we think the person is thinking about us and also what we may be thinking about them. And as you experience, and I don't know where you went with that exercise, you get to this point where everything just sort of melts away and there's this transcendence where it's just energy and you become the person and the person is you and the portal of their pupil. You enter a whole dimension and universe. It's super simple, but every time I do it, I'm always like, wow, so much.
So powerful. So uncomfortable at first. And yet it was transformative in the way that you start feeling all these, I felt so uncomfortable, like wanting to laugh, like, what am I doing? And then kind of getting into it. And at one point there were tears and I was just like, wow, this is so powerful on both sides. And I just remember thinking, like, I really have a responsibility to this other person. That's what came over me in that moment. Anyway, it was super powerful. And I so needed it.
I'm so glad you were there.
Thank you for having me.
So glad you were there.
And I want to talk to you more about, we will talk more about the class. But first, I want to talk about you.
Ah, hi, everyone. Yeah, I'm excited to talk about myself and talk about the class. And if you're new to me as a listener and new to the concept of the class, we'll get into it. But my name's JC. My working title is I'm a founding teacher of the class, which is a movement modality, a mindful movement modality, where fitness meets mindfulness. And I'm the VP of training and development. So that's who I am in the title and the bio.
So beyond the bio, how would you describe yourself in three adjectives?
I would describe myself as passionate, sensitive. And when I say sensitive, I don't mean it in a negative, obvious definition of from a place of overwhelming. I feel it more like as a someone who experiences the world via their senses. That's kind of how my communication works. and stubborn. I'm a Capricorn. I'm the goat climbing that mountain. Don't want to give up. Want to keep going. I think it also comes with being passionate too. Is a little bit of stubbornness. I'm sure my husband would put stubborn at the first of all the adjectives.
I've got to be a Capricorn rising or something. I feel this. Yes,
maybe. What sign are you?
I'm a cusp Sagittarius Scorpio, but more Sag maybe than Scorp, so to speak.
Sag is a great sign. Of all the signs, like whenever I read what I'm compatible with, Sagittarius is always like number one.
And what I also love about being on a cusp is that I get to pick the better horoscope depending on whichever one vibes.
Whichever one you like. It's choice, right? You're just going to lean into whichever one you want is working for you that month.
Exactly. It's like a nice sort of reinforcement. But back to you. When you look back at your life, what are you most proud of?
When I sit with all the things that have happened in my existence, and whether you believe in lifetimes, and I believe in multiple lifetimes, there is an opportunity with the circumstances where that life hands you. When there's challenge, you can like harden up and sort of shut down and close off to life and love. And so one of those attributes in myself that I work really hard on and that I'm proud of is that over time, I've always come back to a place of love again. And whether that love is for myself or whether that love is for humanity or whether that love is feeling the beauty again in life and feeling the magic, where it would be easier just to become kind of jaded and shut down, that ability to move with it and through it and come back to life is something I'm proud of.
And you should be. And is there a moment that you can think of where you say, wow, this is when I first became aware?
There's a lot of moments. I mean, all of it is a million moments strung together. But what stands out are, for many of us probably, is the moments when you experience extreme breakdown and heartache, right? Where either you're on the receiving end of hurt, or you yourself are going against a moral compass in yourself. And that would be a moment where the shame cycle would come in, or that kind of self-narrative where you pull yourself down and making this choice of coming into healing. So I think about that with many relationships that I've had. I think about it with strong personalities that I've engaged with, where I've had to work really hard to find my voice, work hard to learn how to communicate my needs, work hard to stand in my truth and power, when a lot of my early conditioning and patterning was the opposite, was to kind of defer to the loudest person in the room, to let the biggest personality run the show, to let the bully win. And yeah, I guess I'm proud of that too, that I've worked hard to reclaim myself in all of those moments.
There's so much to unpack there, but something that stands out when you talk about coming into your own and learning to find your voice and advocate for yourself, particularly when there are louder voices in the room. Did that happen from a childhood perspective? Was that a familial thing, or was that something that happened later? And can you share a little bit?
Yeah, totally. I think I saw that everywhere from... In my immediate family, I was the only girl and am the only girl. And there are a lot of big personalities and loud voices in my early environment. And then also via the world, the views of that I felt towards me as a female or a female identifying person, which was very much like, it would be just so much better if you just were quiet. It would be so much easier for everybody if you smiled and looked pretty and said yes and were accommodating and nurturing and maternal and all of that kind of projection. I felt it in my environment. I felt it at school. I felt it out in the world. I felt it when I watched the news. I felt it in my friendships. And if I was going to go back through time in the little bit of information that I know of the generation of women in my family, that has been a long-standing road that each woman has been through to find their voice in the world, to stand up for themselves, to advocate for themselves.
And I feel this so much because I think so many of us as women were conditioned to be a certain way, and you described it so perfectly. I won't re-describe, but I feel that and understand that so much. And maybe that's why perhaps it takes not a lifetime, but it takes sometimes decades for us to find our voice, whether it's out loud in a personal social situation or even in the doctor's office, right? So there's so many ways that I feel this statement. So if you could go back in time and redo one experience, what would it be? And would you do that experience all over again?
There's so many moments. And as I was kind of feeling into our conversation today, when we met in Napa and hearing your concept and what you're doing with this podcast, I had this moment last week where I was getting some body work done. I was treating myself to take care of my physical body. I teach a lot of classes and all the things. And there was a moment where like the sheet was being draped over me. And I had this kind of instantaneous feeling of like the sheet coming over me. And this is going to sound morbid for a second, but like, what if this was a final moment? What if this was the end? What would I have done? What would I want to do right now knowing? And I had a moment of peace of all of the situations and everything that's happened to my life has led me to who I am today. So I believe in like the teachers and the challenges and all of the things that push up against you help build yourself in searching for tools and education and creating change, whether that's therapy or whatever you decide to do to form yourself. But when I think back to my younger self, there was a lot of moments in my younger self where I felt that I was the problem, whatever the situation was. So if something happened at home or at school or in any interaction, my tendency was to internalize, implode, and like feel bad. Like I just accepted the blame. Even if I wasn't at blame, for some reason, somewhere in there, I felt things were my fault and it was my job to fix them. And so today I was going into class and I came across this song that I wanted to play in heart clearing. And I thought, and if you don't know what heart clearing is, it's the last move generally that we do in class where we bring the arms forward and back in this kind of repetition. You're working the upper body, but you're also accessing the heart space and moving energy and things like this. And so the song that I found, I wanted to read some of the lyrics, and it's a song by Abigail Washburn and Bella Fleck. She sings, "Feel the fear inside your chest, watch it ebb and flow. The darkest hour dies at the dawn. The darkest hour dies at the dawn. The first clearings are yours to reap and sow. If I could talk to a younger me, I would tell myself to go slow. This time on earth, it moves so fast. And when it's gone, it's gone. If I could talk to a younger me, I would tell myself to be bold, to follow your heart like a bird set free. That dreams cannot be bought or sold, to feel the fear inside your chest and watch it ebb and flow. I would tell my younger self that true love asks for nothing back. Take this world, it's yours to grow." So if I could go back to some of those moments and a couple that really stand out, and some of them sound so trite, right? When you think about yourself as a kid and you think about, I was in grammar school and I had this group of four girlfriends, and we all crushed on this one boy. His name was James. And we all had a huge crush on him. And we were like writing love notes to him and writing, picking flowers on the way to school. We all had agreed that we were going to tell him that we all had a crush on him. And then we were going to let him decide who he liked. So already I'm like, wow, isn't that so interesting? We got together. We didn't talk through what would happen when he picked someone. Like, how are we going to stay friends? Are we still going to like each other? But this whole idea that we were going to tell him that we liked him, and then we were going to wait to see who he liked. So right there, I'm like, okay, little JC, take your power back. It's not about who he likes, right? It's not about waiting to be chosen. So anyway, so he ends up choosing, and it caused a big rift in my little friendship circle. He ended up choosing me, right? But my friends were upset. And so they lied and said, it wasn't you. he decided he was going to choose no one because he didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings, right? So it caused this big thing, and my friends like were mad at me. And it was one of those moments, I'm sure we've all had it in school, where you're dreading going to school. Like, your friends aren't your friends anymore. They don't want to sit with you at lunch. They don't want to talk to you at recess. You're alone on the playground. And this is, you know, I know that I'm speaking from a place of privilege and also opportunity that is like, this is about a crush. This could be so much worse and more intense. And what came out of it was this big doubt in myself that I was like, wow, I should probably never say how I feel because look what happened. You know, I said this thing, I put myself out there. None of my friends want to hang out with me. And it was a long time. I had a lot of like lonely days in that early time. And I had formed this kind of narrative that I couldn't trust females, which came from also not having any in my family. And I had to work through that later in life of how to be with women. So I picture this, and I think I'm maybe like in fourth or fifth grade. So I picture myself sitting in homeroom and I'm alone, right? I'm like teary-eyed, no one will talk to me. All my friends are spreading rumors about me. All these things are obviously not my friends. All I could think about was how I had done this. I had done something so wrong, and I turned it on myself, against myself. And it began the beginning of this lack of trust within myself. So I want to just like hug. I want to hug that fourth grade JC and be like, girl, this is not your fault. This is not your fault. You didn't do anything wrong. It's okay if they don't like you anymore, right? Like, it's okay. It's okay. Who cares? So that's one moment. I have a lot of moments like that, but it was one that came to me in thinking about my conversation with you.
And that is so hard when we look back. And I remember you being a young person too, right? In those moments, that sort of those gut-wrenching feelings in the pit of your stomach, right? Like, someone's mad at me, and how do I fix it? And how do I make it right? And you're right. It was never yours or mine or any of ours to fix. You were honest. You were sweet and kind and naive. The projections that your so-called friends put out there were their projections of their hurt and their selfishness, right? Like, that's what it was. But when you're in fifth grade, fourth grade, sixth grade, whatever, you don't think about these things in that context. You think about and define yourself by who you are in those moments, and like, not who you are, but who likes you. And that feels so hard.
So intense. I really, my heart goes out to kids in school, period. Like, whatever grade you're in, it can be super intense. And we care so much in those early ages about being accepted, being liked, fitting in. Like, I wanted to fit in. I so wanted to fit in. I want everyone to like me. I wanted to make everybody happy. And when each of us are acting out of hurt, we're acting out of pain, right? Everyone was acting out of pain. It's just how they were choosing to act upon it. And you've heard that saying, is like, hurt people, heal people, heal people. And so that's a little example. And I think about it a lot as it went into like future relationships, how I really was like, oh, I shouldn't tell anybody how I feel, whether I like them, not like them, whether it's about a boy, about a girl, whoever. And that carried for a long time of just this idea of like, let's just wait until we see their cards. Let's not show ours first. Let's wait.
You were guarded.
Totally.
Did you have anyone to lean on, or did you really try to work this out on your own inside?
I worked it out. I didn't talk about it. And that's another, as I was saying before, my communication was really hard for me. Like, language was hard. Being a feeling, being a sensitive being, I could feel things, which is then why movement became my medicine. I didn't know how to talk about them. This part wasn't modeled for me. And I had so much shame. And remember, the narrative I'm carrying is that I fucked up. I did something wrong. I turned my friends against me. I ruined this whole thing because of who I am. He liked me. He should have just liked them. Why did I? And so I had this pit of shame that I was afraid to tell anybody. I didn't talk to my mom. I didn't talk to Betty at school. And I remember the school teachers noticing like how I had been ostracized, you know, how I was like on the outside now. And I could see there was like compassion in their eyes, but I don't think anybody knew how to necessarily address it, but I didn't speak up. I just held it and I held it and it ate away and it ate away. And thankfully, in that moment of that period of my life, and always I had dance. So I would go to dance class and move my body, and that's how I would feel better.
Shake the energy out,
lift myself back up. We absorb a lot. I feel that very much in my body, of the absorption of not just our own narratives and energy, but things around us. And movement for me has always been like, okay, I can unpack things. This is mine. This isn't mine. I can hand this back. I can feel myself again. I can find my compass again. And then, not to mention, you're getting all of the feel good chemicals in the brain that we know of, like the dopamine and the adrenaline. So you are, it is a mood booster.
What's amazing that you figured this out at such a young age without maybe even knowing directly as a human, right? Sensationally, like you understood, okay, this makes me feel better. But wow, you didn't do anything wrong. Like, you did nothing wrong. So it's incredible that you were able to find this outlet to work through, or at least support these feelings of shame that you didn't need to carry, right? They were not yours to carry. And I feel for you so deeply, because I think every kid goes through different iterations of feeling these things. And I love how you're putting words to how we perhaps grow into the shame. Speaking of shame, right? The infertility is a huge source of shame. So what I would like to know from you is, you've been very open about your fertility experience and having unexplained infertility. How did that affect your mental health, and how did you move through that?
It's a tough one, right? It's a tough one. And what I know about through the work of the class is, even the memory that I shared earlier, that moment, the things that get kicked up are the million memories before that, the million experiences before that. And so when the unexplained infertility came through, it was kicking up all of the same stuff, right? It was kicking up, this is my fault. I fucked up. How did I get this wrong? I'm broken. I'm failing life. I'm failing as a woman. I'm failing as a female being. I'm failing my husband. I'm failing my family. All of it would get kicked back up. And I spent a lot of time in this war with my body of like, oh, wow, it can't do this thing that in my whole life, everyone said, this is just what your body does. I didn't have any education that your body might not do it. My mom had five kids that she raised six, but she had five out of her own body. And I hadn't had any models or role models or education around any of this. So there was not a thought in my mind ever that this was even, one, how common it was, two, how unspoken it was, and the stigmas and all of it. So when I entered that diagnosis, everything just kind of blew up in my face. And in a way, I'm really grateful for it, because I recognize how naive and also unaware I was of, no, this is something that affects men and women. And getting pregnant isn't necessarily something that just happens. So all of that brought my mental state to a challenging place. And then you add on the medications, which, you know, grateful for medication and science, and the hormones, which are a very real thing. I know people are like, hormones, you can't see them. They're not real. And how that,
they're very real.
How estrogen affects your brain, everything, your body, what you're feeling in your body, going through the procedures, being probed and prodded, all of the stuff, it really pushes into some seams. So I struggled.
Of course you did. Unexplained is 1 in 4 people, I believe. And I believe now the new stat for infertility in general is now 1 in every 6 people globally, according to the WHO, the World Health Organization. So we are definitely not alone, but those feelings are so real. And the medication, they're like the devil's drugs. How did you handle the whole entire process of it? And how did you take care of your mental health?
I tried a few different things. I mean, thankfully, my husband was amazing through this process. He gave me all the injections. He did all the mixing of the drugs. He did all the shots. He let me cry. He let me be uncomfortable. He let me complain. And he has a very unique gift of remaining positive in the face of all of it. So he was a big part of it. I also used my Labradoodle, who is my furry baby, was my emotional support animal. I mean, it's so funny. It's like divine timing. Thank God she came into my life when she did. And so I thought about her a lot. Like in all of the procedures, I would look at her photo before my egg retrievals. I would look at her photo. I would wake up from anesthesia. I would look at her photo. I would come home. I would hug her. I would cry into her fur. She would lick my face. She was a big piece of therapy. And you know, if you've gone through any of this, you know that there's big periods where you can't do any movement and impact and jumping and all this stuff is not okay for you. So walking, breathing, and then once I could start moving again, that was the thing I was really looking forward to. It's like, okay, I know how to move this through my body when I can start moving again, which gave us an opportunity at the class to create this program that we created called the Fertility Series, where you hear from a group of us as class teachers on our journey with fertility. And then we created meditations and some light movement and more intense movement when you're ready to help process, whether you're egg freezing, whether it's loss of child, IVF, infertility, grieving. And therapy was a big piece. I have a really wonderful therapist and she helped a lot.
Amazing. I am a huge believer in therapy as well. So when you were going through your experience and your journey, that was the reason that you created this beautiful program through the class for others that are going through infertility?
I shared my story and there was an overwhelming response from people sharing their story and like so thankful that I was talking about it. And we were paying attention to that of like, wow. And then started to educate ourselves more of how common is this? And then we opened it up into the conversations with the teachers, like who else is maybe experiencing anything on this path and what can we do?
And how did it feel the very first time that you shared what you were going through with infertility?
Ooh, it was scary. It was really scary. And when I was talking about it with some people close to me, I had varying opinions, right? Some people that were like, this is a big mistake. Don't do this. you're going to be pigeonholed into this forever. People are always going to look at you as being infertile. And then I had people that were supportive and were like, wow, good for you. If that feels right for you, great. Like, what a great thing. It's so interesting because being in the health and wellness world and in fitness, there was this expectation where people would look at me and they like couldn't believe, this is where education comes in. They like think fertility looks a certain way, right? It's like, but you look so healthy. You're so healthy. You drink green juice. You do this, this, and this. Like, I don't understand. And it's like fertility does not discriminate. You know what I mean? It just is, it doesn't look. So I felt there was such a great learning opportunity of, what are we doing? Why do we do this to each other? Why do we look and say, oh, it looks like this, or it doesn't look like this, or it happens here, but it doesn't happen there. So I was excited to break that kind of glass ceiling.
I'm so glad that you did. You've definitely normalized the discussion in more of a mainstream conversation pertaining to fertility. And I think that is so necessary. And I'm grateful because I've been waiting for businesses and for public figures to really start coming out. And yes, I know some celebrities have come out and shared their stories, and that's lovely. But usually they share their stories once they get to the other side. So it's really empowering to know that you're one, not alone, and two, that there are people that look like JC and are super fit and healthy and are doing all the things, that understand and sadly have had to be in it too, right? It normalizes and makes the rest of us feel a little less broken. And yes, that's where therapy comes in. So what would you share with someone who has recently been diagnosed with infertility?
I would share that, you know, you're not broken. Your body's not broken. You're not less of anything. You're not less of a woman. You're not less of a mother. You're not less value. You're not less worth. This diagnosis doesn't have to define you for the rest of your life. You know, it doesn't have to end with this. It doesn't have to be the thing that is the, you know, these marks that we give ourselves. And then the rest of our life, we're just like, that's it. I'm in this one box. I would say be patient and loving with your body, even in the moments where it's the hardest. Like, can you love yourself more? Can you be even more gentle? Can you find even more compassion for your body, more compassion for your heart, more listening to what's going on? I would say if it's accessible in some capacity to have a support circle, and that could be therapy, that could be a group you join, it could be a find a few friends, but to be able to be in a safe space, because not a lot of people know how to talk about it. There were situations for me where I just was like, oh, well, I'm going through this. And when I was ready to talk about it, once I started talking about it, part of it was like, oh, other people don't know how to talk about this either. And it was so uncomfortable where people were like, oh my God, you're talking about your uterus or babies or your vagina. Like, stop, just stop.
Vagina.
Stop talking.
People freak out when you use the word vagina because we don't talk about that. We were raised that that was some dirty word that you didn't talk about.
All of it, whatever you want to call it, your vulva, your yoni, whatever. Or the fact that it was like, oh, you just want to hear maybe about the baby being in the belly or the cute clothing or the, you know, like the rainbow and unicorn of this. But that's not the reality, you know, it's not the reality. So to have people that can talk about it with you and hold space for you that aren't judging you and working through their own stuff, you know, I found myself in many conversations where I was like, oh, wow, I have to like take care of this person right now because they're so uncomfortable. They don't know what to say to me. So I would default to that rather than kind of doing what I needed to do for myself. So finding a group, finding people that can hold space for you, that can talk about it without shame and judgment, that are aware of what this means, and give yourself time. You've heard all of the stories, right? You hear people that go through some type of procedure, they get pregnant right away. You hear of people that are like 8 tries, 10 tries. You hear of people that decide, you know what, this isn't for me, that move to adoption, that move to surrogacy.
Or stop altogether.
Or yeah, like this isn't for me, period. Like there's like, I'm not going to do anything, but I've explored this and now I'm choosing to not explore it anymore, which is fine. But it can be different. It can look different. And whether that is literally children coming out of your body or somehow children coming into your life or animals or not children, that it, yeah, there isn't this like fixed picture. I think like when we were little kids and got read story time books, there was a fixed picture of family and parents and children, and it all looked this one way. And as we know today, this is not true. It's not real.
Exactly. What popped in my mind when you said that was the Brady Bunch and how that was so revolutionary at the time, right? Like two different families coming together, like that was revolutionary. And now I think we're redefining what parenthood can look like. And quite frankly, I think we're redefining what motherhood can look like. Motherhood doesn't necessarily mean that there is a tangible baby. There are so many ways to mother. And I think that is so important to share because we have to get away from this fixed idea that a mother looks like a mom, a woman with a baby or a child, right? I think we can redefine motherhood these days. I think we're being given the opportunity these days to be able to talk about how to mother in a different construct. And when you think of motherhood, what do you think of?
Yeah, I have been constantly revamping that view of what I was taught and told and shown. And I go right to the source now. I'm like, okay, original Mother Earth, original Mother Creator of life, that which does give life, which literally then is everybody. And I don't mean give life like create a baby and it comes out of your body, but a transference of energy. Some, anyone that lifts anybody up, anyone that offers a heart and a hug, anyone that is in a moment of nurturing or mentoring or an exchange of unconditional love. I mean, there's so many books and different techniques about mothering yourself of like, okay, whatever happened, happened, but there's a whole healing technique about mothering yourself and stepping into that for you. Doesn't matter, you know, who you are, if you identify as female, male, or what you're building for yourself. So, I mean, I have, like I mentioned, my dog Chili is a big part of my healing journey. And there's no part of me that doesn't feel like I'm her mom. She didn't come out of my body. I'm not, you know, like I know she has her mom and her name is Lucy who birthed her, but I feel very like, no, that's my baby.
You're connected.
It's my baby.
Absolutely. And you're a mother figure as well to an amazing community through the class. I have seen you live on a stage of sorts, taking hundreds of people and holding space and mothering them and me and so many to look within themselves, right? So I think there are so many different ways in which we can do that. And clearly you've done so much work in terms of mothering yourself to be able to give that energy to others, which is so beautiful and rare. That's hard.
Thank you. Thank you.
So speaking of movement, how has movement been a defining theme throughout your life?
Movement and through the modality of dance was my first love. My mom had me in dance lessons as soon as I could walk. And part of that, I think, was maybe I needed somewhere to put my energy. And also she had raised a bunch of boys that in the culture of our environment, it wasn't thought about boys going into dance. So for some reason in the culture of my environment, it was like, oh, there's a girl and now she does dance. And there's a lot of things that my mom, I think, tried to activities that she was hoping I would pick up, and really I picked none of them up except for dance. As I mentioned before, I knew at a very young age I was a feeler and that I had a hard time expressing myself. And it very instantaneously just became this thing where I was like, I just know how to do this. I don't know how to explain it, but I know how to do this. I know that I'm communicating with my body and whatever this is, it feels good. So I followed that thread of these things feel bad. Let's not do them anymore. And let's follow the things that end up feeling good, which would be something of a self-regulating process that's healthy rather than numbing ourselves out or doing something to take away a feeling that would have a negative result. So it was just very natural for me. And whenever I would step away from movement, I would not be in a good place. Like my mental state was not good. My emotional state wasn't good. My health wasn't good. So I just started to track that of like, everything is just better when I move. I'm better. I'm a better person. Life is better. I feel more like myself. And I just kept following it. So dance brought me to yoga and yoga brought me to spirituality. And then spirituality brought me to healing movement. For a period of my life with movement, I was in a performance competitive dance world. And as much as I loved that and fell in love with partner dance, I could see that my way was not for performance and competition. It was for healing. And that was what lit me up. And then that became the thing that I really wanted to share, which was very organic. I never in a million years thought I would teach movement. Never. I just was like, I'm a student. This is for me. This is helping my life. With that narrative of self-shame and lack, I just was like, God, I could never be a teacher like that. Those are for people that are experts. They have degrees and they did this and they come from a family of movers and dancers. That was not me. No one else in my family, nobody, no one. So I had a lot of story about this until people just started asking me to teach them. Just like, hey, you know, do you think you could just help me with this? Or could you maybe teach my daughter? And I just started doing it, even though I was feeling imposter syndrome. And it started to feel good for me. It started to feel good for other people. And then I thought, okay, well, maybe there's something here.
Imposter syndrome is so real. We don't talk enough about that. How did you meet Taryn Toomey, the founder of the class, and how did the class become a part of your life's work?
So at this period of time where I'm exploring healing, movement, I mean, yoga and spirituality, and I'm taking yoga with this teacher named Allison Sinatra, who, this is in New York City, and this is probably 20 years ago or something like this. And she created a women's collective at this time when women's work, women's circles, women's healing wasn't very mainstream. And she would gather women together. We would do these retreats upstate New York. We would go to her class. She brought us on retreats to Peru multiple times. I traveled to India with her for a month. And Taryn was a part of this group. So I was a part of this group. Taryn was a part of this group. And I didn't really know her. Like, I knew her. But at that time, I think she was living in Boston. But I always looked at her and was like, wow, this person just has the thing. Whatever that thing is, this person has it. I didn't really know that much about her or her life, but she had a charisma and an energy about her that you just, so magnetic, you can't help but just be drawn to her. Fast forward, we go to Peru together. We're in this women's group together. And a friend of mine is like, oh, Taryn is teaching this class. This is around 2012, 2013. We should go take it. And so I messaged Taryn, hey, I just ran into so-and-so. She told me about this thing you're doing. I would love to come. Taryn said, great. My classes are sold out for this many days. And at that moment, I'm like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? So she's like, I have an opening. Somebody late canceled. Come. Definitely don't be late. You want to be there early. And I come into this dance studio in Tribeca. That was like a children's dance studio. So there was tutus and Barbie dolls and kind of like stars all over the wall and pink things and ribbons. And there's this room buzzing with 40 women that feel strong, you know, not physically or look a certain way, but there was an energy in the room of, wow, something's happening here. And class started, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who've had this experience. In the first few seconds, I was just, something hit me. And I was like, wow, there's something here. And whatever this is, I want to be a part of it. I don't even know what that looks like. And I came back and came back and came back and just kept coming back. And I really felt that Taryn was onto something that was going to revolutionize the way that we move our bodies. And it incorporated, because at that time I felt like, okay, you do yoga over here, you go to the gym, maybe you do an aerobics class, maybe you're in therapy. But I hadn't experienced something that brought together so many different techniques and modalities in one. Taryn was getting really busy and having more opportunities. And she asked if I would be interested in maybe covering for her, teaching for her. And I said, no.
Why? Imposter syndrome or just because?
I think here I am, right? Where there's the theme and all of these things we're talking about. I just looked at what she was doing and I was so blown away by it. I just was like, there's no way I can do what you're doing. And it's called The Class with Taryn Toomey. It's called The Class with Taryn Toomey at that time. But she, you know, she has a way really, and I've said this a lot, she has a way of seeing things sometimes where you may not see them yet. And she saw it, and she saw it in me. Fast forward a couple of months later, I taught my first class, and that was in 2014. And then by 2016, I became the director of teacher training and development, and then kept on growing with the class full time.
The class is an experience. I have been many times, some in Tribeca, but mostly out east during the summers. It's transformative. It's like a version of therapy for me. I've had sometimes a little bit of issue truly describing what the class is because it is so transformative, it's hard to put words to. So when someone asks you, what is the class? How would you describe it? And why should somebody try it?
So there's lots of ways to describe it. And it is very layered. Sometimes you have to feel into the person and feel into like, what is the right explanation for this person? Because the beautiful thing about the practice is it meets you wherever you are. Like wherever you are is what you're going to get, which may be different than the person next to you. It's a morphing organism that is literally like medicine, where you take it and it affects people differently. But if I was going to give you the, this is what we say it is, so that you can conceptualize what we're doing, it's a map-based, music-driven workout where mindfulness meets fitness. It's fun. It's a challenging workout. And what we're actually going to do with the body is strength training, cardio, and mindfulness in an experience that will make you feel better. You're going to get a physical workout. You're going to get a mental workout. You're going to get a spiritual, energetic, emotional workout.
It's truly therapeutic.
It is a therapeutic, cathartic workout, which means the processing of strong emotions. It is an opportunity to look at our thoughts. This is where the meditation comes in. It's a moving meditation. We're observing thoughts. We're observing patterns. It's an opportunity to reprogram, confront those patterns, belief systems, redefine ourselves. And then it can be whatever it is that you need. It could be all of that. It could be none of that. It could be the most fun way to move your body with great music. And it could be, this is what my soul has been yearning for.
You totally light up when you talk about your work and the class. I love it. So you've shared that being a student is one of your love languages. So tell me how you are a student when you're the teacher.
I love learning. Learning is really one of my love languages. We approach the work that we do at the class. When you look on the bio and the website, it says teacher. We approach it from a co-facilitation place. I am co-facilitating, me, JC, the teacher, as well as all the other teachers of the class. We are co-facilitating experience with you. We're not doing something for you. We're not gurus. We don't have all the answers. We are working with you. We are co-facilitating together with the energy in the room to create an experience for you to get what you need and do what you need. Personally, I just don't think we ever stop learning and growing. I just don't think it works that way. And if we arrive at a place where we think like, we got it, we did it all, that's usually when shit breaks down. So I approach it from this place of, I always want to learn more tools to help, more tools to support, more information. Information is coming out more and more these days. Like the science of all of this is changing so drastically. The information about mindfulness and things, mental health, like things that we didn't know. So I want to incorporate as much as I can into what I do. And obviously, like, I want to do the best job that I can in co-creating that space for the people who love the class.
Speaking of mental health, how can others use movement as medicine, even at home or in their daily lives, when they can't get to the class?
The great news is we have an amazing digital platform at the class. You can become a digital subscriber. And if you join our digital subscription, you get meditations, you get walking meditations, you get the class, and then you get the class in many different variations. 5-minute classes, 10-minute classes, 20-minute classes, 30-minute classes, themed classes, classes about fertility, classes about menopause, classes about grief, classes about joy and celebration. We have the class at work, things you could do at work. Classes that you can take outside and not even have to do them on the screen. So the digital platform has grown into a massive library of many, many ways to either move your body, move your breath. And that could look everything from, if you're someone who wants to do burpees and jumping jacks, to someone who would like to deeply stretch or do a walking meditation. We added yoga and meditation this year to the platform. So now you're getting it from all the angles.
How do you use movement as medicine on the fly?
Wherever I am and whatever I'm doing, movement is important to me. And that could be making sure I walk my dog with my husband every day for like extended periods of time. It is me teaching. It is me taking class. I take a lot of class. Part of my job is in training and development. So my job is to be in the teacher's classes. So I get to be a student multiple times a week in other people's classes. And as I mentioned before, with like learning being one of my love languages, taking outside classes, going studying with other people, trying new things, seeing what else is out there.
Beautiful.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Over Again podcast. I hope that you learned something from today's episode. If you enjoyed this, please leave a 5-star review about All Over Again on Apple Podcasts. Please also let me know what spoke to you about the episode on our social media channels @AllOverAgainPodcast. I can't wait to hear from you.